More drugs working their way down to the lay public from the EMS sector. What's to come in the future? Well, if that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on this week's special episode of The Medic Cast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is The Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Medic Cast, our podcast for EMTs and paramedics everywhere. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome you to this week's show. We've got a great episode for you. In this week's episode, I bring you a special segment I recorded with Greg Fries from EMS1.com about public access albuterol inhalers in schools and other locations. What other EMS emergency medications and interventions are going to move to public access? Greg and I discuss it all in this special episode of The Medic Cast. Before we get to all that, though, I do want to make sure you're checking out on some things like the links and additional information that are available for you over at the Medic Cast blog at medicast.com/blog. There's a show notes link at the top of the page. You can click that link and find the most recent episode listed first, or scroll down and find other episodes. There's also a search box on the upper right-hand corner of the site, so if you're looking for something in particular and you can't find it, you can enter a keyword there and take a look. But take some time and make sure you follow up on the information you hear me talk about in the show notes. Understand how it applies to your own EMS practice and protocols. If you want to get back in touch with me and you have a comment or a question on an episode, I hope you'll do so. Email me directly at podmedic@mac.com. Shoot me an email with your comments, questions on episodes, or maybe suggestions or interview ideas for future episodes. Either way, I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, and I will get back to you as well, so please keep them coming. That's it for our contact information. Let's go ahead and get on into the show, but a quick reminder, we're going to be live in the Physio-Control-sponsored podcast studio at EMS World Expo in New Orleans coming up in the first week of October. If you're there, I want you to stop by and say hi. I'm going to be there with Chris Montero, Sam Bradley, and some of our other favorite EMS podcasters and bloggers, and we can't wait to see you. That's it for announcements. Let's go ahead and get on into the rest of the show. It's coming up in just a sec. EMS1.com editor-in-chief and good friend of mine, Greg Fries, reached out to me recently about an article that appeared on their site regarding new congressional attention on getting albuterol inhalers in the hands of school nurses and administrators to treat emergency asthma attacks in the schools when the child forgets their own inhaler. This follows other treatments and interventions that are moving from the traditional EMS sector to public hands, including naloxone, epinephrine, and AEDs. What's next? Greg and I discuss it in this segment coming right up. Hey, Greg, it's great to have you back here on the show. It's been quite a while, and we were talking before we started recording that it's been a while since I've had you on the MedicCast, and that's a problem for me because you have a lot of great stuff to share. So welcome back.
Well, thanks, Jamie. I appreciate it. And I'll do my best to continue sharing great information with you and your listeners. And, you know, as I was catching up with the show recently, I was just really admiring how long you've been doing this for. And it's you have either passed or are about to pass 500 episodes.
Yeah, coming up on 500 episodes before the end of this year.
Wow.
It'll be 11 years anniversary in February.
And so this has to be the longest running EMS related podcast and likely one of the longest running podcasts for healthcare providers.
I think it's the longest running healthcare medical podcast, continuously running podcast that's out there.
Wow.
In medical space that I know of. There may be one that I'm not aware of, but it's of the ones that I know of that are, you know, on the radar. This is the one that seems to have stuck around, and in no small part to people like you who've supported it, who've been a listener, been a guest, and I think that that's part of what makes this work is that it's a community effort.
Excellent. Jamie, have you had on yet somebody that, you know, maybe listened to the podcast as an EMT student, continued as an EMT and a paramedic student, and now is working as a paramedic, a professional that has then come on to be a guest? Have you had that sort of?
You know, I haven't had that person on, but they do exist. I get emails from them all the time. And, you know, I'd have to reach out to the audience and ask if anyone would be interested in coming on and talking about that. But that's a great topic. And are people out there. I mean, in fact, I know for a fact there's one young lady who started listening to the show when she was 14. She wanted to join her local fire department as a cadet. She became a cadet. She became an EMT. She went on and ran with her volunteer squad here in Maryland for several years while she was in college, and then went and got her nursing degree.
Excellent.
So, you know, all the way through that process, she listened to this show and then transitioned over to the nursing show, which I also do. So it was really interesting to hear that.
Well, I think as you surpass that 5-century mark, I would challenge your listeners that have been with you for a long, long time to sort of raise their hands and say, you know, I've made the leap from learner to teacher, and now I want to go on and share my experiences and knowledge with other Medicast listeners.
Cool. I think that's a great idea. So you heard it here from Greg, and I wholeheartedly support it. Please join us and come on and be a guest on the show. I know there's been people that have come through and done that, but we haven't talked specifically about how people have progressed over the years as the Medicast has been on. So that's a great topic. So Greg, we're going to be talking a little bit about public access as lay people to medications, and specifically albuterol. Now we've looked and seen this happen with epinephrine, with Narcan or naloxone. And now there's something in the news about albuterol, and I saw it over at EMS1.com. You brought it to my attention, and I appreciate that. Why don't you fill us in a little bit about what's going on with this?
Sure. Thanks, Jamie. So I've long been fascinated by treatments that make the transition from intensive care or surgical care to emergency department to ALS providers in the field to BLS providers and then to lay people or bystanders. And, you know, the best example that maybe a lot of us don't think about is that defibrillation once was something that only happened in surgery with a patient's open chest. And then it became, well, how can we do external defibrillation or by putting the electrodes on the patient's skin? And if you go back and you look at the photos from the Columbus Division of Fire, and they had this massive intensive care ambulance, they called it, but it was really this massive motorhome. And now to these little tiny defibrillators we see out in the fields. There's been all sorts of things that have made this transition. So, you know, I'm the editor in chief at EMS1. That's my work. And so when I see news about treatments that are not only for EMS providers, but for, you know, treatments that are moving from hospital to EMS to lay people, I like to share that out with our readers and then this opportunity to engage with you about how that's happening. So, there's legislation that's been introduced in Congress, the school-based asthma management program, that's going to encourage through federal funding schools to make available albuterol to students that are experiencing an asthma attack. And, you know, as you know, and EMS providers everywhere know, that there is people that have asthma that go out and about in their communities, whether it's school or work, and don't have their albuterol with them. And, you know, sometimes that leads to an exacerbation and then leads to a 911 call. And then we're treating asthma in somebody's home or place of work or even a school.
Yeah, and that's something that's it's a very common emergency. And that's something that we all train for, whether you're at the BLS or the ALS level. I think every BLS provider is trained to assist somebody with their existing albuterol at the very least, and some cases may actually carry their own inhalers as well. Of course, ALS providers have nebulizers and multiple medications they can use in that route. But bringing this down to the school is basically saying, you know, if the kid leaves their albuterol inhaler at home, that there would be a resource at the school to immediately administer this rescue medication and maybe stave off the need for calling EMS.
Yeah, well, and, you know, there's all sorts of, like, potential impacts. One is, you know, it might, reduce the need or likelihood of an EMS call to a school for a student with an asthma exacerbation. It could also reduce the need to call a parent and pull that parent away from work or what they're up to try to get asthma medication to a school and potentially delaying a treatment. You've probably been in the situation where the school calls you up and says, you know, your kid forgot their homework, their violin, their, you know, medications. Can you bring your child's medications to school? So, you know, maybe this kid can get treated sooner and potentially when they're having a mild asthma attack versus a moderate or severe asthma attack. And the other reason that I find this especially fascinating, so it's the first day of September 2016, and for the last couple weeks, the news has been dominated by the cost of EpiPens, so the auto-injector to deliver epinephrine for somebody experiencing anaphylaxis has dramatically increased in the last 10 years. And finally, that has captured the mainstream media's attention, if you will, this dramatic price increase. Mm-hmm. And now we have another medication that is attempting to seek even more widespread ubiquity in schools. And then, you know, does this, if we drive up demand for this medication, will that then also drive up the price and then impact EMS agencies that are oftentimes have a regulatory requirement of how much of this they carry?
I think that's a great point. And we saw this with naloxone. We've seen it with mm-hmm. the EpiPens now more recently. And I think that, you know, in some cases it appears, and we don't know for sure, but the appearance is that the demand is created when school systems across the country will, or in some cases with naloxone system, jurisdictions across the country mandate that certain drugs be carried in certain locations.
Right.
And when they do that, it becomes, you have to purchase this drug. Well, if you have to purchase it, I don't have to necessarily discount that medication.
Right, exactly. Right?
And so that's the perception, especially with the EpiPens, is that, you know, we know how cheap Epi is. If we're a paramedic and we draw up Epi in a syringe, it's what, $1, $2?
Yeah, it's dirt cheap compared to an EpiPen.
Charging $600 for an EpiPen seems like, you know, highway robbery. And, you know, I mean, for lack of a better term, and they get away with it because they're the only source to do that. And right. I know that we've seen some BLS jurisdictions, rather than purchase EpiPens, go the extra route of the medical director saying, look, it's not that hard to teach an EMT to give a sub-Q medication.
Subcutaneous or intramuscular. I think one of the things then that is part of this, needs to be part of this discussion, and, you know, it's not likely occurring at the federal level, but I'm sure it's occurring at the implementation level, is, you know, whether it's EpiPens or other forms of delivery, naloxone, and then potentially albuterol. You know, I think there's suspicion oftentimes on the side of trained healthcare providers of, like, wait a minute, you mean I received all this training on how to do this, and now you're just going to let cops or teachers or somebody walking through the school or the airport do this thing that I've been trained and certified to do and have in my state legislated scope of practice? That suspicion often arrives. And then it's also oftentimes pitched in the form of, like, well, these are, you know, the side effects of this medication can be dangerous. And, you know, we don't want to just willy-nilly give albuterol to anybody that's anxious or complaining of a breathing difficulty. And, you know, schools, especially as we get to sort of the high school and college level, but certainly at the high school level, you and I have probably both responded to a high school student with breathing difficulty, that really what they're having is a panic attack.
Right.
And panic attacks are not resolved with albuterol.
No, they're not. In fact, they're exacerbated in some
right.
cases. And that's, I think that's the point. And I was looking at the way the article was written and the way the law seemed to be laid out, and it was unclear as to whether this was limited to patients or students with identified asthma. So,
right.
you know, that's, and of course that's, it comes back to the BLS rule, right? Right patient, right drug. So
right.
does this drug have belong to this patient? Because if it isn't, then in the BLS setting, most cases you cannot give that drug because it's not prescribed for them. So is this a case of we have an identified student or students in a school who have asthma? We know they have asthma. Today they forgot their inhaler, but we're going to use the school's inhaler for them because we've identified them as having this disease,
right.
and we can treat them under the suspicion that their respiratory distress is as a result of asthma.
Well, the and you know what, I just want to circle back to the conversation about costs. I think that inhaler becomes a single-use item,
yeah.
even though it might come out of the box with, I'm not sure the number of sprays or in a...
A lot of them have like 100 doses
yeah,
in them.
Yeah, so I would think really it's a one-time use for that child. So then, you know, how many do you keep on hand?
Yeah.
You do send that inhaler home with the kid, and then it's, well, this is yours now. You know, there's a number of complexities here. The other one that's intriguing to me is just how schools, you know, schools across the country are being pinched for resources. And a school nurse in my community might only be in any given elementary school 1 hour per week.
Wow.
And, you know, there's probably also communities that have a dedicated nurse that's in the building. Whenever the building's open, that same nurse is there all day long, where, you know, places like my community, one nurse is covering multiple schools, and that nurse is rotating a few hours a day in each school. So that, you know, then it becomes a like, well, you know, who's the default, you know, school nurse when the actual school nurse isn't in the building? Is it the principal, or is it an administrative staff person? You know, there's a number of differences here between, I think, albuterol and the asthma in terms of like the time it takes asthma to become life-threatening versus anaphylaxis to become
right.
life-threatening. Certainly cardiac arrest, you know, it makes sense that we
yeah.
would want anyone
well,
in
you're
school
right.
to
you can
to
make
treat
the argument,
that.
You can make the argument that you can put defibrillators in the school and EpiPens in the school because they are time-sensitive treatments. And not that albuterol and asthma are not time-sensitive, but certainly the window of necessity there is much different. And
mm-hmm.
so maybe in a rural school setting where, you know, the ambulance is going to be a half hour away, albuterol might make sense in that school setting. But where I am, where average response time for paramedics on the scene is 8 minutes,
yeah.
you know, we've got no reason really to have albuterol in the school here, I don't think.
Yeah. You know, and I think the other alternative for schools to consider, and I would think that you have listeners both among the nurses and EMS that not only are there parents that have kids that go to school, but maybe are asked by teachers or principals, you know, what should we do? I think the best course of action is to encourage families to leave one inhaler at the school if the school has the capacity to store medications. You know, so then your child, should they need their inhaler, there's one there. You know, I know a student, he is allergic to bees and has a history of anaphylaxis, and that family keeps a set of EpiPens at school. And then we also, that family has EpiPens at home.
Yeah. And you know, imagine the cost for them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that we're looking at $2,400 to keep EpiPens stocked every year.
Oh.
That's insane.
Yes.
But
well, I think that $600 is for a two-pack.
Is it for a two-pack? Okay, yeah. I was unclear on that. I heard it both ways, and so I was erring on the side of most egregious. But
yeah,
you know, that's either way.
One other treatment that I want to make sure we include in this conversation is hemorrhage control and tourniquets. And that's been another thing where, you know, bystander bleeding control is clearly become a thing and where I think there is a need for it. You know, the school that my children go to, they have a wall cabinet with the AED in it. Right above it is a wall cabinet with EpiPens. I don't think there needs to be a wall cabinet with tourniquets, and I don't think there needs to be a tourniquet in every teacher's desk, but I do think that teachers need to learn about controlling severe bleeding, extremity hemorrhage with direct pressure and a tourniquet, potentially an improvised tourniquet. You know, I think if schools decide that they would want to stock, you know, tourniquets in the building, I'm not necessarily against that. I'm not sure if there's quite the need, say, compared to, you know, if you have limited resources, make sure you have an AED in the building, number one. And if you have a very large school with limited resources, maybe have two AEDs in a very large building to lower your response time. And then as you have increased resources, be thinking about bystander epinephrine and bystander bleeding control supplies.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I've taken to carrying around in my glove box of my car a soft T tourniquet, commercial tourniquet, because I just was like, you know, it's one of those things. If you need it, you're going to need it right there and right there. And I figured carrying one with me, just if I happen to drive up on a motor vehicle accident with a severe injury, or God forbid we have a mass casualty or active shooter situation in my community, where I'm near the first ones to respond once the scene is cleared. It is going to be necessary for me to have that, because we often respond directly to the scene rather than going to the department first in our community, right. And then meet the ambulance there.
How would you have a school prioritize the equipment they might purchase for some of these bystander, you know, emergencies that bystanders are increasingly being called upon to act?
Yeah, I think you're right on the money with the order you laid out. You know, obviously defibrillators are first and foremost. I mean, the evidence is there for sports-related injury alone to alleviate sudden cardiac arrest in students. And then down from there, epinephrine is certainly the most time-sensitive emergency that I can think of. And followed closely by hemorrhage control. I think teaching, you know, doing a basic class with teachers, teaching them first aid, and along with that application of improvised tourniquets is something to consider. The other thing, side of it is a commercial tourniquet isn't all that expensive.
Right.
And, you know, and their shelf life is, you know, nearly very as long as the school needs to be. So,
yeah.
You know, you could stock a couple of those. Even if they were in the principal's desk drawer, they'd be available when needed in a situation where appropriate. So I think that's something that, you know, in that order, I think albuterol's way down the list for me. I was kind of surprised by reading this article that this was seen as such a urgent thing. Because, I like I said, in a very rural community, perhaps this is necessary. But I suspect in rural communities that there's a probably they're prepared for more options based on these types of situations than in my community, where I would think it was completely needless to have albuterol in the schools.
I'm primarily thinking at the high school level. Do you think it makes sense for naloxone to be on hand for a school nurse a teacher
Actually,
to administer?
Is you know, I completely skipped over that, but, you know, in our community, yeah, absolutely. We have a huge heroin problem here in this community.
Yeah.
And it reaches down into the middle school ages sometimes, unfortunately. I know of one instance where a young elementary school age kid brought something in to show his friends, and ingested something that required a naloxone administration. So we certainly, I think, have the problem with opioids in this country. I heard one statistic that the United States represents such a small fraction of the world community, and yet we administer 90% of the pain medication in the world. We certainly have a problem with the way we prescribe pain meds. And so I think naloxone is probably higher on the list, closer to EpiPen.
Okay.
If you're going to have something like that, if you have that problem in your community, then it's likely you're going to need that resource. And, the people that say, why do we need this in our schools? Well, anybody who responds to schools in the community will probably be able to answer that pretty quickly.
Yeah, you know, I think you mentioned sports-related injuries with AEDs. The other thing to keep in mind is just that, a school building is oftentimes part of the community, and it could be occupied as early as 5 or 6 in the morning, not only by staff, but early arriving children. And then oftentimes, especially at the high school and junior high level, a school can be occupied well into the evening for different types of events. And then the age profile of the people in the building can really change in the late afternoon and into the evening. Not only is it the young athlete that might be in need of that AED, it's the people that are in attendance, the parents and grandparents, for whatever the events might be. I would encourage listeners to think about these first aid supplies more broadly than just the kids.
Yeah, it's not a pediatric population because of the multi-center, multi-purpose use aspects of many school buildings and facilities.
I'm part of a community organization where we hold our monthly meetings in a middle school, and so there's a group of adults, one night a week. There's probably 50 of us or more, and the average age of that group is probably well over 60 years old. And so I'm that really changes, like you said, the demographics of the people.
Interesting to point out, we have a lot of systems out there, places where defibrillators are required equipment in schools or public buildings or what have you, depending on the state or the local jurisdiction's regulations. And yet we've seen defibrillator prices, public access defibrillator prices, come down.
Right.
It's interesting to compare that to what the drug manufacturers seem to be doing with the prices of mandated medications based on some sort of understanding that there might be increased demand. I'm not buying that they're running out of supply. I really think this is in relation to mandated things. So it's interesting to see two different industries how they've handled pricing of these types of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do you think's next, Jamie? That's the one of the things that I'm interested in, not only you, but to hear from the listeners. Like, what are other medications or treatments that will make this transition from, hospital to ALS to BLS to lay people?
Well, I think something as simple as aspirin for somebody that might be having a heart attack. Mm-hmm. I actually teach that in some settings for when I teach CPR. I talk about the fact that based upon a person's patient history, for an older person that might be having a suspected heart attack, that aspirin may be considered if it's available in that setting. So that's one that leaps out to me right away. And I think it's not discussed very frequently, but we certainly use it readily on the ambulances. For an adult, giving them a single 81 milligram dose of aspirin is not, before paramedics arrive, is not going to have any significant adverse effects in absence of an allergy.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. So here's something that I'm keeping my eye on, and it's ultrasound. And I'm not sure what the bystander application of it is, but that an ultrasound at one point was wheeled around on a gigantic cart in the hospital. And those carts have gradually gotten smaller. And now that we see that there's ultrasound devices that are going into ambulances, and now there's ultrasound, wireless ultrasound probes that basically are about the size of your hand, and they communicate wirelessly to a smartphone or a tablet, so you can see the image on a device that you already have. And, you know, I think there's going to be some sort of consumer ultrasound probe, much like you can buy an infrared sensing, you know, basically it's a thermometer measurement temperature device for, you know, $15 or $20 and just sort of point the thing around your house to see where there's cold air leaks.
Yep.
I'm not sure what the application is, but there's going to be an opportunity where ultrasound is accessible to anyone.
Hey, I could see, you know, I could see if the pricing comes down far enough on a small portable unit that communicates with a smartphone, maybe with the capability to record images and mm-hmm. record what they see. I could see young couples recently pregnant purchasing them to just look at the baby. You know, whether they can get the type of definition they want to get or not, just the fascination of the of looking at the baby through the abdominal wall and being able to maybe detect heartbeat or not. I mean, if you learn how to detect a heartbeat, and a lot of times these consumer versions of medical gear are specifically said not to be used for medical applications. A lot of the pulse oximetry devices that are out there will tell you that this is not to be used for diagnostic purposes. However, if a parent were to say, I always am able to detect a heartbeat and this time I'm not, I don't have a problem with responding to that call based on that initial assessment.
Yeah, well, as long as it's not operator error, you know, but you could be running a lot of calls. I would just want to wrap this up by asking the listeners, like, what is something that's a treatment that's maybe an in-hospital treatment now that you see moving into the ambulance or eventually to lay people? And then also just a final thought to think about the time that, you know, how, you know, it took decades for defibrillation to move from the operating room to the ICU to some sort of like physician driven around a community in Columbus and I think Belfast or Dublin. I apologize to your Irish listeners that I can't remember which community in Ireland. And then, you know, into a portable device just for paramedics and then to a portable device that can be anywhere. That took decades. Narcan, the window for that was really short, you know, from hospital to from ALS providers and then from ALS providers to lay people. That transition for Narcan was over months, measured in months. Mm-hmm. And so I think those transitions are going to get shorter. And so, you know, listeners, what other medications or treatments are going to transition from being the providence of EMS to accessible by lay people?
I think that's a great point. And we welcome all of you to either leave a comment on this episode. I'll make sure they get to Greg, or shoot me an email, podmedic@mac.com. Greg, would you like to share an email address or a location where they can go and send those comments directly to you?
Sure. So editor@EMS1.com is a good email to reach me at. And then the EMS1 Facebook page, facebook.com/paramedic, is another way listeners can send me a message.
Excellent. Well, and so folks, answer these questions. Give us your comments and suggestions or what your thoughts are about what we've talked about today. And Greg, let's make sure it's not so long between times we chat.
But for sure, Jamie, always happy to be part of the MedicCast.
That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week. And of course, remind you to follow up on all of the information you get in this week's show over at the MedicCast blog. That's at MedicCast.com/blog. Over there, you'll find a show notes link at the top of the page. Go ahead and take a moment and follow up on all of the information and links to news items and more you find there each week. You can also sign up for our email newsletter that'll bring you those links directly into your email inbox each week if you want. There's a form on the right-hand side of the page. Just go ahead and fill that out, and you can get the MedicCast newsletter for yourself. I also welcome your comments and suggestions by email. So if you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com. Send in your ideas for news links, ideas for future show topics or interviews, whatever comments you might have. I really do look forward to hearing from you, and I'll make sure I get back to you. I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, so please keep those emails coming. If you want to catch up with me on social media and some of the pages and sites out there, you can find me at most places under the handle Podmedic. So you can catch me over at Twitter at twitter.com/podmedic or Facebook at facebook.com/podmedic. Friend or follow me over there. Also, don't forget to check out our MedicCast Facebook page. We now have over 5,000 followers, so head over to facebook.com/medicCast. Click the like button on the top of the page and join the community over there. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. Please make sure you spread the word and share the MedicCast with your colleagues and students and friends in the EMS world. I'll be back here each week with new episodes, new interviews, news items, tips, and more every Monday morning to start off your EMS week. Tell somebody else about the MedicCast today. I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. It's time to close out the show. Don't forget to thank our sponsors, and remember, folks, Scene Safety, BSI.